Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WESA's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Blaine Martin. Blaine Martin is a writer living in the Philadelphia area. He received his BA from DeSales University and his MFA from Carlow University. Martin's poems have appeared in Apiary, Girls with Glasses, Shaking Like a Mountain, and other magazines. His chapbook, A Whole Armada of Loss, is available through Plan B Press. Hi, Blaine. How are you?
I'm doing wonderful, thank you. Long travel time aside, it's great to be in Pittsburgh again.
Yeah, you're here from Philadelphia, and we're really so happy to have you. We've been talking about doing this for a while, and so we're anxious to hear some poems, so go ahead.
All righty. Fishing at Unami Creek, Sunday morning. I used to pray on old stones I pulled up from the bed of Unami Creek, worn a smooth, faceless gray by the cool water, while my father cast a line into his own reflection in the first heat of May, the thaw over and done. He was hoping for a trout to break through the ripples, mouth working open and closed, gasping for air. I would pick out the best pebbles and move downstream, drop each one into the water, circles moving out through the glare of sun. I would close my eyes as tight as I could, like light was the furthest thing from salvation. And if I let it break through the dark of my eyelids, I would leave the whole world damned. I'd slowly mouth the names. Mary, who still prayed the rosary 5 times a day, even though she hadn't been to Mass in 15 years. Sitting in the gazebo, letting the beads click through her fingers like bones. Brandon, with his eyes that never met yours, who hung himself later that year because the quarterback beat him up for liking boys. My dad would call me back when his line tugged, lock his arms and struggle to pull the fish from water in a blazing arc, wet eyes rolling in socket, landing in the dust on the bank. So this poem, I've always had a fascination with the idea of how we lose control of ourselves over the years. My collection, A Whole Armada of Loss, the title comes from a poem about someone losing their memory. And this poem is about someone slowly losing their eyesight. And I got the idea, I was outside at my old house smoking a cigarette, and I looked through our window, and I could see through the entire house through another window and see flowers in the neighbor's yard. Counting flowers through. 1. I could paint you a sunset that you have never seen. My palette lets me mix colors that don't burn in our skies. A touch of blue added to thick red paint, and you can see things how I do. A slow fade of color, like adding water to a bucket. Then I can make the clouds real before your eyes. A little bit of black to the white, just the smallest amount of yellow. And they'll look so real you could reach out and grab them. Shape them into the clouds you watched when you were 7 in the park before your grandmother died. 2. This morning I counted the flowers through the window and 3 were gone. Yesterday they were deep blue. Rich like my Mark's eyes, and overnight they melted like glaciers, translucent as the waters off Sebago, where my daughter Susan would wrap her lips into an O with laughter as she played in the low waters. But today I needed reading glasses to make out the letters of her face while she told me about my grandson playing with their new terrier. Sandy red and white, she said when I asked. I think it is his face that I will miss the most. Watching it spread and become tan like the wheat fields we come from. Watching him grow tall like the mountains that break the gray skies around us. 3. This afternoon I sat down to play Brahms' lullaby, and the notes scattered like small white things, shivering beneath a lifted rock. I tapped out the notes to 3 blind mice, which I had memorized in the 3rd grade. After I went to town watching the yellow lines tick past the bus window, I bought The Great Gatsby, The Sun Also Rises, and Los Más Bellos Poemas de Amor on tape. I stopped for coffee and watched the cups steam from night black to tan. 4. This morning I counted the flowers through the window, and there were none. Only my voice as I told the vase holding Mark's ashes. Yesterday there were 4. They were the pink I always made to paint flowers. Mostly white, with just a drop of red. Like Susan's skin when she came out of me in the August heat.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Blaine Martin. Blaine, I wanted to ask you about the voice in your poems. We've talked about it a little bit, the sense of the authentic that comes through in your work. And I'm thinking, you know, listening to you, that it's a mixture of some really well-chosen details, but also the moments of plain speech that come in your poems. For example, one line I think was, I think it is his voice I will miss the most, or his face. His face I will miss the most. But the plain spoken nature of that, I think, among those details is really strong. Can you talk about all that?
Yeah, I think, personally as a poet, and I've always enjoyed the more kind of abstract and strange poets the most, but that's also not the voice that I find the most authentic to myself. And when I write poems, I really do try. I mean, obviously you need to insert some poetic verse, but I really try to make the voice of my poems very conversational and easy to access. And I think that because so much of what I deal with is loss, whether it's the loss of a person or, you know, the loss of a sense, it becomes so much easier to relate with when you can combine that kind of very narrative, simple voice with the constructs of poetry.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I think the narrative voice is one of the constructs of poetry. And
that is very true.
And also, you know, thinking of, I mean, always go back to James Wright, you know, all I can do is speak in a flat voice, which has so much power. But I think it's so interesting that, you know, when you find out what people read and how often it's so different than what they write, can you talk about your interest in very strange or absurdist poetry?
I mean, Russell Edson, as far as kind of the far end of the absurdist stuff, I think that his power is his ability to create these surreal and absurd worlds, but do so in such a plain narrative that he transports you into that world and he makes it believable, even though he's talking about kind of the strangest things. But beyond that, I've always found kind of the surrealists of Central and South America really powerful. I mean, in Counting the Flowers Through, I specifically mentioned the 3 books I mentioned are probably the 3 books that I would have the hardest time not being able to read again. Mm-hmm. And one of them is the 20 Poems of Love by Pablo Neruda. Mm-hmm. And he is probably one of my favorite poets, and does something that I don't ever really do in my poetry, which is those kind of beautiful but absurd and strange kind of images of, you know, his love as bread or his love as a spider. Mm-hmm. Trying to hide. And I've always found that powerful, but something that I don't think makes sense for my personal voice.
Mm-hmm. Could you read some more poems?
Certainly. Catching Air. She says it's easy to catch air, and I imagine her a child. Small fingers wrapped around the glowing underbelly of a firefly, creating a tiny cavern of light, a sun to give life to a whole colony of dust particles. She had always had that finesse that I lacked, the one necessary to ease a herd of fireflies into a jar to make a lantern, or coax a caterpillar into an old Philly's cigar box, so that we could witness change. Not like the chemicals that were adjusting in our bodies turning us to adults, but the kind of change that I had always hoped for. Wrapping myself in blankets so tight that it rewrote my DNA, turned me from a small silk spinner into something larger, something with wings. Now we've both gone through that wrong kind of metamorphosis. She got breasts and I got pubic hair. She's telling me that air is easy to catch, like air is a bucket of sand that you can thrust your hands into and pull it up. Watch it run through your fingers into small ant mounds on the beach, waiting to be washed away by the tide. I know that she's full of crap, but something about the breasts and the pubic hair leaves me there nodding my head like an idiot, trying to return to when we captured bugs, played in the mud. I'd even take that time that I broke her favorite wiffle ball bat and tried to hide it, so I wouldn't have to be the one to teach her that sometimes the things we like get broken, and sometimes those things get broken by people you care about, so you don't know the proper amount of anger to feel or how much sadness. But now with the breasts and the pubic hair, I stand there listening to her talk about air and about catching it between her long, thin fingers that look too big now to capture fireflies, but still seem delicate enough to reach into the cavity that holds my organs and explore, snapping bones, pulling out veins, breaking whatever she wants. These two poems that I'm about to read are linked, I don't think, in a way that they're necessary for one another, but the stories are kind of continuations of one another. Traditions are written on our skin like ink. It's that taste on the back of your tongue, almost like scotch, almost like Pall Mall Blues, definitely like bile, that I woke up to every morning after Diane told me that I wasn't what she was looking for anymore. Like I was a classified ad in last week's paper, and what I was offering was already sold, probably to some old couple that skimmed four different counties' penny savers, who pulled up in their old Buick, two shades of eggshell white. I imagine she helped them load the crate in the trunk, watched as they drove off down the road to the garage sale on the other side of town. After I got upright, a feat of strength not unlike the 12 labors, I made coffee, put two ice cubes in it the way I would when Diane spent the night, because she was always too ready to wait even a few minutes for it to cool down. Like all of life depends upon the scars you carve on the inside of your mouth. I started drinking my coffee black after we met, and it still tastes bitter, but it helps to kick the cramps out. I steal the neighbor's paper, start circling. Work isn't slow, but I need something to fill the time up. Like desire is the empty space at the top of a cup. If I let the water form a convex meniscus, I can forget that you left your toothbrush in my shower. And it is still there. And I still take it off the ledge to wash it. What is the sound of forgetting? The first thing to go was the toothbrush. It was the easiest, sanitation being the perfect excuse for separation. I took it down, like I had in the past while you were in Rome, to wash it. Instead of putting it back on the upper ledge of the shower, I tossed it in the trash can. I only thought about pulling it out one, two, maybe three times before I emptied the can on Monday night. Next to go was the constant checking on OkCupid and Craigslist to see if you had shot yourself back into orbit, wondering who you would be looking for. It obviously wasn't me, but I wasn't sure who would be the next to get caught up in the gravitational pull of your eyebrows. The books you gave me to read, along with the odds and ends you forgot the last time you left, stayed in a box at the back of my closet, out of sight, but still there. Now they're stamped and in transit, the last pretense for us to meet on its way home. The final touch was erasing the picture you had drawn the night you first came over. We were listening to a mix CD you had made, and you got up to dance in those plaid pajama pants. Eventually, you wandered over to the whiteboard next to the bar and drew an astronaut holding a cup of coffee. After a few too many glasses of whiskey, there I was, spraying the picture down and wiping up with paper towels. Images turned to purple handfuls of pulp. This is the sound forgetting makes. The sterile squeak of Windex on a whiteboard.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Blaine Martin, reading his work. You know, one thing I admire about your work, Blaine, is, you know, how you're not afraid to go into tough places and talk about loss. I mean, your chapbook is called A Whole Armada of Loss. And, I mean, I think, seriously, I think that's really difficult to do and to sustain emotional life of difficult poems. Can you talk about the process of doing that and if it's a conscious decision to keep writing about loss?
I mean, as far as the second part of that question, I don't know if it's a conscious decision to continue. I think to some extent it is. And I think for me, a big part of it is having had a fairly normal middle-class suburban childhood. I often think that I don't necessarily have interesting things to say as a poet. And loss is kind of the one territory for me that I think I can engage people on. I've experienced quite a bit of loss, whether it be people, relationships, various things like that. So I think that to some extent, if it's not completely conscious, it's at least somewhat conscious to discuss that concept at great lengths. And I find that there's kind of always new ways to talk about it. It's such an overarching theme of our lives that it's there. As far as going into those difficult places, that's something that I had, I think, as a younger poet, a hard time with. And various mentors through my writing career have really pushed me to go into places. I would write poems that kind of skirted the edges of those topics, but never dive in because it is difficult to dive into those in a real emotional and honest way. But through the help of my writing mentors, through my bachelor's degree and my master's degree, it's something that I force myself to do now. And it's definitely a conscious decision in my writing process where when I start writing something, I make sure when I'm revising that I always take it kind of two steps, three steps past where I'm comfortable. Mm-hmm. And if it gets too real, I can always pull back, but I need to make sure that it's real enough.
Sure. I mean, and you can always go back to it later or years later. Yeah. Yeah. Well, and as you know, there are plenty of poets who don't go there, who don't dive deep in their work and can write solid poems, but it's a different type of poem.
Yeah, I think there's plenty of subject matter that doesn't necessarily require that level of depth that allows you to write a perfectly fine poem without it. But certainly loss, loss and sexuality, I think, are the two big things where if you're going to write about that, and that's something when I've taught or run workshops, I think that's the most mm-hmm. common critique I give is you're skirting around this issue, dive in. Or cut it out.
Okay. Yeah, love, sex, and death. Let's not forget. So I'd like to hear some more poems. Are you planning on reading? I know you have a father poem.
Yeah, I plan on reading that one.
Oh, that's good.
One of my, if I had a greatest hit, that's probably it. I'll read that one now, and then I have a couple other poems, depending on how time works out.
Okay.
So this is the title poem, as I said, for my chapbook, A Whole Armada of Loss. Forgetting Philadelphia. Dad did demolition for 48 years and his brain never quit, taking Philadelphia apart brick by brick. First the buildings, City Hall leaving Penn standing waist deep in rubble. Veterans Stadium with its blue and red seats. Hard plastic that held him gently after so many losses. Next to the bridges, the Ben Franklin blue steel and lights sinking into the Delaware. The Walt Whitman. The Commodore Barry, which he had only ever driven over once. Finally, the streets were stripped from the nooks of his brain. Walnut and Market, gone forever. One time we found him pacing out front of the house, and he stared at our faces like pictures in an encyclopedia whose pages had all been ripped out, folded into ships and set to sail, a whole armada of loss rolling slowly on the waves before going under for good.
Yeah, nice poem.
Thank you so much. Keys. I forgot how to count when I was 16, Annabelle said, flexing her fingers like they were 10 thin keys carved like scrimshaw, ready to twist the tumblers to something locked away in the 92% of my brain not being used. After the ninth boy I kissed at my cousin's quinceanera in the soccer fields, after all the sweaty men cleared, Annabelle and I sat down on the goal line, wrapped like an ampersand, her legs bent, one under, one over, my arm around her shoulder, feeling the shiver of early fall move up and down her spine. They left their leather smell and cigar smoke, empty beer bottles. His name was Miguel. He tasted like bubblegum and cherry coke, the last number I remember. I laid back, letting our legs untangle with the finesse of a seamstress removing a knot from a spool of thread. Annabelle's voice was a crow looking for its murder in the darkness. The clouds shifted in the sky, revealing new constellations that I had not learned the names of in science class. People leave, she said. We deliver them to the dirt like dust or to the wind like migrating birds. So I stopped counting. Forgot which numbers followed which, let the curves of 8 and 9 decay like leaves, the simple elegant lines of 1 and 7 become fences. It seemed like she had run out of words, too, as we followed the halogens that led us from the park to our houses 2 blocks down. She didn't have any vowels or consonants left to reassure me that I wasn't lost in the leaving of numbers, that our fragile fingers entwined weren't left out to return to the earth, that she hadn't built a fence to separate her yard from mine. A short history of cinnamon. Traders used to tell the Egyptians that birds in Sri Lanka set up nests in the tallest trees and would nestle in on cold nights to craft cinnamon with their beaks out of sultry spices grown in only the most temperate parts of their island. The great black cormorant's fine-tipped bill was best for this procedure, patching together bits of cardamom and clove, turmeric, ginger, tamarind, and pepper to create the long, curled sticks that the Egyptians would take home, grind up and mix with natron to stop the smell of human decay. I've written my history in track marks. I rented the room for 3 hours and went in alone. I lay in bed and watched the smooth motions of my naked body in the mirrors on the ceiling. I could see bruises and small puncture wounds of pale white sand, the radius of blues and grays that moved out from the center. I ran my finger from injection to injection and thought about each high, the straight line from plunger to tip, the heaviness that followed. You could trace my track lines, if you want, down my limbs like traffic on I-95 and know what it's like being almost somewhere.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Blaine Martin. Can you tell us about your revision process? Because I know with some poems, you've talked about revising many, many times.
I have. And I mean, some poems I find require a lot more revision. I have a tendency, I think, as a writer to write very short, compact poems, which is something that I think does a disservice to some of the themes I talk about. So one of the first processes when I'm revising is to unpack. I'll put down, you know, maybe 14 or 15 lines as a starting off place, and then unpack those to turn it into, you know, often 3 or 4 pages, kind of bouncing off different lines, knowing full well that a large portion of that is going to get cut back out. But to make sure, Jeffrey McDaniel had told me in my manuscript defense to make sure that you kick every tire 2 or 3 times.
That's kind of good advice.
Yeah, I think that is one of the best pieces of advice I've ever gotten. So I make sure that every image, every thought in a poem, I expound on and then pull back on. Mm-hmm. And then I do a lot of cleanup work. I have a tendency to overuse conjunctions. And in poetry, I think that's a lot less necessary. So there's always a pass through in my revision process where I just remove extra ands and buts and thes that are really unnecessary.
Well, it sounds like you do a lot. Time is moving here. I'd like you to read one more poem if you could.
Oh, certainly. Tropicana Orange Juice Jar, Philadelphia, 1922. My grandmother kept half dollars in an old orange juice jar above the neon green dish drainer, which always held a knife, fork, breakfast plate, and the pan she used to make her eggs, cooked with the fork to make them extra scrambled. It isn't much, she'd say, but when I pass, I want my grandkids to split it up, buy something small with it to remember me by. When she died, the summer before my junior year of high school, my parents gave me the jar, filled to the rim with silver half dollars and the yellow piece of legal paper, her barely legible scrawl of numbers written in felt tip marker, 8750. I bought a small box with it, left a few of the coins in there. I kept the jar, too, used it to keep bottle caps. During a party once, a friend stumbled into the fridge, and I watched as the jar fell, hit the ground. Shattered. I still make my eggs extra scrambled the way she taught me.
This is the poetry of Blaine Martin. Thank you so much. That was really wonderful.
Thank you so much for having me. It's an honor. I've been listening to Prosody for quite some time, so it's a real privilege to be part of the show.
Thanks, Blaine. You've been listening to Prosody, WESA's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in every Saturday morning at 6:30 for Prosody 90.5 WESA.